and welcome to the War Room. I am your host, Sean Ferrick, and joining us this week is, I'm actually really excited to say this, Alan Dean Foster, who is the author of numerous award-winning books. He has written in tie-in media, he has written in original fiction, story by credit on Star Trek The Motion Picture, novelization for the original Star Wars, as well as Star Wars The Force Awakens. He has written the novelizations of Alien, Aliens, Alien 3, Alien Covenant. I am super excited to welcome this incredible author. No, I'm actually, to be honest with you, I'm a tiny little bit starstruck because, like, you're the success story we all want to be when it comes to writing and everything. And, like, you're kind of amazing.
Well, it wasn't planned. I was supposed to be a solicitor, lawyer. And I started writing my senior year at UCLA at university. And did well in my classes and thought, instead of going to law school, which I wasn't really looking forward to, but it seemed to be what my life's course was leading toward, I thought I would go to the master's program at the university in writing, film writing, and have some fun watching film history courses. And then, other than that, to fill my requirements, I took some writing classes, did well again. Thought I'd try some prose, sold a couple of short stories while I was at university, one to John W. Campbell and one to August Derleth. And I thought, this is fun. This beats getting up early in the morning and looking up precedents for the rest of my life. So I thought, anyway, I tried a novel. I figured in 20 years at one of these dull lawyer-esque parties, when someone said, what are you doing? I could say, well, I'm working on a novel. Good party conversation, and it sold, and I was off and trotting, not running, but trotting. Running came later, and that's how it all got started.
That's actually, like, it's so cool. Like, well, I suppose we've already kind of started the pod, but just, like, the sheer amount that you've written is, I mean, like, so I write myself, and I've spoken to another couple of writers on this pod, and some would have quite large bibliographies and some would have quite small bibliographies. And then there's Alan Foster.
No, everything's relative. Okay, I will cop to being a fairly fast writer. But there are people like Robert Silverberg and Isaac Asimov who have written hundreds of books, and I always... When this subject comes up, I always mention the French writer, Honoré de Balzac, who wrote, I think it was 60 or 70 books, but with a quill pen. Oh, now, if you can conceive of that, and you dip your, and you write, and then you have a blotter over here to try and correct your mistakes for your publisher, that was not too long after coffee had been introduced into Europe. And apparently he became a coffee addict, and he would sleep all day and drink coffee and write all night. So when people complain about not being able to write on their self-correcting computers with all sorts of built-in assistance, I mention Balzac and say, you know, try writing three pages that way, let alone 60 or 70 books. But yes, I do write a lot. Okay.
That is, like, and you know what, like, both of those. Oh, have I frozen up now? Hang on, I'm just gonna let's just the
image. The sound is fine.
Oh, okay. I'm gonna just close some of the programs on my computer, just in case it's using up any of the thing there. Now, hopefully that works better. So I never actually introduced myself. Hello, I'm Sean, and it's very nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you, Sean.
Well, thank you very much. Full disclosure, funnily enough, even though, obviously, you know, massive Trekkie, and I'm going to talk about, obviously, your career with Star Trek and Star Wars as well, my first introduction to your written word was the Alien novelizations.
Okay.
That was, and I loved them.
I'm glad you did. Alien, people will often ask, which is the novelization you're most proud of? And I have to point to Alien because When I got the material back in those days, there was no way to send it. There was no internet. So I would get a package that would usually include the screenplay. And if I was very fortunate as the writer, I would get pictures of the actors so I could at least describe them accurately in the book, and maybe some images of the sets or costumes or props. I tried to be as accurate as possible, obviously, in the books. But I'm going through this package from 20th Century Fox. Obviously, this is thousands of years ago. And there's no picture of the alien. So I called my contact at 20th Century Fox and mentioned that fact. And he said, well, we're not letting any pictures of the alien out. And I said, but I'm writing the book. I have to know what the alien looks like. The book is called Alien. And the gentleman at Fox, I'm sorry, we're not letting any images of the alien. So the book, if you read the book, and you obviously have, there's no description of the alien in Alien. Subsequently, with that wasn't a problem, but it was a very difficult way to have to approach writing the book. I did the best I could. I think it worked. People seem to think it worked. But every page was difficult for that reason. So I'm particularly proud of that novelization.
That is fascinating because, you know, when you think, obviously, you mean the Xenomorph is one of the most iconic images in all of cinema. So how much was there much of a, you know, collaboration with 20th Century Fox for, okay, look, I've written this. Does this track? Is this okay? Would they send notes back going, no, you can't have it as a, I don't know, an eight-legged thing crawling up the wall?
No. And generally, that's the case. Studios regard novelizations as an ancillary right, just like selling the rights to use your character's images on McDonald's drink cups or boxes of KFC or bed sheets, whatever. And their interest is almost exclusively in the film. Charlie Lippincott, who was responsible for such things for Star Wars, kind of changed that with his deals with Kenner Toys, for example, and newspapers for serializations of versions of the film. But around that time, and subsequently for many studios, they really didn't care, which from a writer's standpoint is exactly what you want. The less interference you have while you're writing the book, the better it is, not only for the writer, but I think also for the finished product, for the finished book. So no, I had no interference on Alien whatsoever. I had no interference on Aliens, although there was a terrible thing that happened subsequently, which I had nothing to do with, which I'll tell you about real quick since you... I finished the novelization. I turned it in. The publisher was very happy with it. The studio was very happy with it. I got paid. I was very happy with it. And sometime later, I get a letter from a fan, no email yet, saying, you know, I really love the book, but why did you take out all the cuss words? And I thought, I didn't take any cuss words out. In fact, I might have added a few. And I picked up a copy of the book. Sure enough, all of the Space Marines talk had been bowdlerized. And most notably, the famous line, "Get away from her, you bitch," had been changed. And I was quietly infuriated. There was nothing I could do because it's not my original work. It's a work for hire. And I later found out that Warner Books had done this because somebody, to this day I don't know their name, had decided they might sell a larger proportion of books to younger people if the cuss words were taken out. Because, of course, younger people don't know any cuss words until they turn 21. And then they have to go to school. I mean, it was outrageous. It was just outrageous. I was angry. I'm sure Jim Cameron was angry, but I had nothing to do with that. Alien 3, wrote the book, turned in the book. Publisher was happy. But it was one of those rare occasions where the people behind the film got involved. And Warner Books got a letter, which was passed on to me from Walter Hill, who was one of the producers, saying, you can't do this. You have to write the book exactly as the screenplay is written and follow it exactly. And what I had done, of course, since Alien 3 had kind of a disaster of a screenplay, was try to expand upon the story in the sense of, you know, why are all these poor schmoes on this prison planet? Why are they being treated so badly? Why do you kill the little girl, Newt, when it's not necessary, which I did fix and managed to fortunately have them leave in the finished book. And a lot of the things that I did along those lines had to be taken out. So when they offered me the job of doing the book version of Alien Resurrection, I turned it down. I didn't want anything to do with the franchise or the people behind the franchise, at least insofar as the book was concerned. And many years passed, and I got a letter, and a new publisher with whom I'd worked before, Titan, had acquired the rights to do the book version of Alien Covenant and what was supposed to be a sequel book. And I said, no, I'm not doing this. And I explained the whole thing I just explained to you. And they said, you don't understand. There's nobody who was involved with Alien 3 working on this film. Nobody. But Ridley Scott is doing it again, Alien. And I thought, okay, if Scott's involved, then it at least has to make a certain amount of sense, obviously. And I said, send me the script. And I read the script and I thought it was fine. So I did it. And then I outlined a sequel as they originally proposed. And before it could go any further, they said, no, we want a prequel. So I'm like, okay, prequels are very difficult to write because you know what's going to happen. But I said, okay. And then they said, there's just one caveat. You can't use the alien. So I'm okay. Here we are again. Okay, I need to write a prequel to Alien Covenant with no aliens. I did the best. I argued as long as I could, but it's like trying to argue with a dyke in the Netherlands. You get no response. And I did the best job I could. The book became a book called Alien Origins. Hmm. And what I did was essentially go back and do as much Weyland Yutani as I possibly could, because that was the only contact I could find with him. And it, you know, it tied into the previous Alien stories. Now, of course, the whole franchise has expanded so much. You know, we're doing Alien grandmother books now, and that's fine. It's not my universe. I do the best I can with the material I'm given. I try to participate actively as much as I can, but they did at least accept Alien Origins. And I managed to sort of, I don't know if you've read that book, but sort of sneak a little reference to the aliens in there in the form of visions that the semi-crazy, anyway, I want to give the whole book away, but I managed to get aliens in, even though they said no aliens. So you do what you can.
I'm well played as well, because it's not like being an author who writing media that ties into existing. It's not like it's thankless, but it's hard. It is hard because you have this format, this frame that you have to keep in. Obviously, there's a great example of it. It's like, hey, don't use the alien. It's called Alien. You know, or going back even further, we're not going to describe the alien. Okay, all right. But then do you find that creatively it kind of gives you a bit of a push as well? Because it obviously, so right, you might have thought it was going to go in one direction, but actually you've got to go in another one.
Well, it forces you as the writer to compensate somehow. I mean, you're trying to put together a 75,000-80,000 word novel. You have to have something to write about. And so you find ways, like I mentioned with Alien Origin, you find ways to work around the restrictions that they put on you. Most of the time, to be fair, I have no trouble with studios. They put no restrictions on me. If they want to cut something out, which happens more and more, because now, particularly with big franchises like Star Wars or Star Trek or Alien, now you have groups, you have committees that vet everything that goes into a book, or as they'd call it, a product, and everything that comes out. When I did the novelization of Star Wars, I did it, I wrote it, George read it, he said, that's fine. And that was the end of it. That was great. But Star Wars grew somewhat. And now there's a committee that goes over all those things. And so when I did the novelization of The Force Awakens, although it was fine, it turned out fine, there were certain things they wanted cut that I didn't see from a writer's standpoint needed to be cut, did not contradict anything in the film, but they get very, very picky about certain things. And as a work for hire, as someone doing a contracted work, you can only go along with it. You have no choice. I always stand up for those things, for what I write, or I wouldn't have written them in the first place. And I don't just throw stuff in there. I have a reason for everything I do. And after I've explained those reasons, if they still want something cut or changed, then I have to cut it or change it, because that's just the way it works. It's the nature of the business. It doesn't mean I'm happy with it. And then sometimes I put something in almost just for myself and always for the fans that I think for sure they're going to cut, and they leave it in. So you never know. I'll give you an example if you want. In The Force Awakens, we have a kind of super Death Star kind of setup that destroys entire solar systems and fleets many light years away in real time. This presents, now I know Star Wars is science fantasy, everybody knows that, but it has the trappings of science fiction. And where possible, I like to retain the trappings of science fiction. So I'm reading this in the screenplay and I'm thinking, well, this doesn't really work in the real universe, but I'm going to fix it as best I can. Can you excuse me one second?
Yes, of course. Yep.
Sorry. Spam.
No.
So I'm going to fix it as best I can. So I went and I did a fair amount of research on how you would actually, according to the laws of physics that we observe, blow up a planet. And I put that in the book. It's about 2 pages of very heavy astrophysics. I figured there's probably 12 people on the planet, myself not included, who can actually understand all of this stuff. So nobody who reads this is going to understand it anyway. And therefore, if I'm lucky, it won't get criticized. And I had a lot of fun with, just on the most basic level, dark energy. We have the dark side of the Force. We have real dark energy, stuff like that. And then a lot of terms like quintessence that nobody but astrophysicists would have a grasp of. And I tried to make it work to the point to where if Neil deGrasse Tyson read those 2 pages, he wouldn't go and throw up. And also the problem of how do you do this in real time? Well, the weapon folds space, so point A and point B are suddenly congruent. And they left it in. They left it all in. And that made the book for me as a writer, as the writer. I was fine with everything. It's okay, you want to cut this, we'll cut this. You want to cut this, we'll cut this. But you left that in. You left my research in. Thank you very much. And there will be some fans who will appreciate that. So sometimes you get away with stuff.
I love that, though, because that is, you're, and I, funnily enough, I was thinking on a property like Star Wars, as you say, that it's now as big as it is, and there's so many, you know, cooks and so many. I thought that'd be the very one where it's like, nope, there is the screenplay, write the screenplay. That's what we're, so I love that idea, actually, that you were able to get something like that in. And it was funny because I'd read that you'd done the original novelization. And I just love this idea of, you know, George Lucas going, oh, yeah, that's fine, because it just wouldn't happen today, or it feels like it just wouldn't happen today.
Now, there was a meeting with myself at Universal before Skywalker Ranch existed. George rented space at Universal Studios. It was an old building, and there was a meeting with myself, George, Gary Kurtz, the producer, and Charlie Lippincott, who I've mentioned already, to discuss the book version of the film and Splinter of the Mind's Eye, the original sequel that I wrote. And it was, took very little time. And George, we discussed some other things. Charlie Lippincott kept records of all of this, which is available, I believe, for people to research. And George wanted to try some other things like, can we open Splinter of the Mind's Eye with a bunch of Wookiees on animal back and charging and stuff like that. I tried very quietly. I'm very diplomatic. I always speak my mind. It's one reason I don't work in the movies and politics. But gently tried to, Charlie did, to gently discourage the idea, and it did not make it into the book. But people who work in film are fond of throwing out ideas just to see what might stick. And I have no problem with that, just as I have no problem defending my point of view. So the meeting just, you know, George, still working on the movie. The movie's still in production at this time. And George and Gary and Charlie had other things to worry about besides the novelization and the sequel book. And as long as they were competent, I'm sure they would have been happy with it. I always try to do better than competent. But and people seem to think that it worked out fine. But it was a very, it was a reasonable, I don't know, ran an hour the whole meeting. It was the only time I had any direct contact with George or Gary on book. They had other things to occupy their time, which subsequently we all know it was a hectic production, which would be, you know, an appropriately descriptive word for what went on.
I think so. I think we could use other words to describe it, but I think the editor might come and take those cuss words out afterwards. But it's fascinating. Was there anything, because I think you have this unique position where you've written this sequel book to what becomes one of the biggest films of all time, and then a sequel comes out. And, you know, is there a moment where you're sitting there going, I can't wait to see my book on screen? What's all this on the ice planet? What's all this?
Of course. I mean, who wouldn't? I always thought the idea was that I should write a sequel that could be filmed on a low budget. This is all written history, but I'm happy to repeat it. People ask it all the time. The idea being that if Star Wars, the film, was not a huge success, or not a big flop, George could do a sequel on a lower budget. And the idea was to utilize as many of the props and costumes as possible from the first film. So that's why I set it on a fog-shrouded planet. Remember, there's no CGI in those days. So easy background. A lot of it takes place underground. Easy background. I'm trying to think of ways, while I'm writing the original novel, that it could be filmed cheaply, which is an interesting way to approach writing a novel. It turned out fine anyway. But then Star Wars came out. Suddenly George had all the money he wanted to make any film he wanted to make, and he ended up making The Empire Strikes Back. From my position, I was prepared for that from the beginning. I've been around the movie business long enough to know how such things work. And your work very, very rarely gets filmed in any way, shape, or form. So I was prepared for it. The other thing was, I went to a private showing of The Empire Strikes Back, and I thought it was a great film. I enjoyed it as much as anybody. I always thought at the time, because of the way Splinter of the Mind's Eye was structured, they could have done a really nice movie for TV and slotted original movie for television and slotted it in, which they used to do a lot more of, slotted it in between episode 4 and episode 5. I thought that would have been really cool, but it didn't happen, and that's fine. It never will happen. There's been radio adaptations of the book. If you're around the movie business, and my uncle was a very well-known producer in television, Howie Horowitz, he did Batman on TV, among other things. Yeah. Yes, he was the producer. Loved science fiction. Saw it kind of floating around the fringes of the business, even as a kid. And I knew how it worked. You cannot go in thinking, well, they've bought my screenplay and they've signed so-and-so. This is a long ways along the process. They've signed so-and-so to star in it. And this guy has been signed to direct it. And they're going to start filming next year. And then what happens is the production company runs out of money and goes broke. Or the studio has a change of executives, and all those projects just get thrown away. There's a book that was written, and I can't remember the name. I apologize to the two authors. Husband and wife writing team wrote a screenplay, sold it, went through various studios, different executives, different production companies. I think they wrote like 20 versions of the screenplay to try and satisfy each successive group that was interested in making the movie. And the movie finally got made. And which version of the screenplay do you think got made? The first one.
Oh.
The original one. And that's the way it works. As William Goldman says in his book about Hollywood, Adventures in the Screen Trade, the key to understanding Hollywood is nobody knows anything.
Mm. It's funny, the last two episodes of Star Trek that have aired have both contained variations of the phrase "fake it till you make it." And I think, you know, if over the door of the underworld there's abandoned hope, all ye who enter here, I think over the door of Hollywood should be "fake it till you make it."
Yeah, or abandon hope, all ye who enter here, also works.
We could put that in the kind of either the smaller text just underneath it. It's like we're gonna have a little bit of reality. So you've been literally on the ground floor of building two of certainly our fans' biggest or most favorite sci-fi franchises, which is Star Wars and, of course, Star Trek. You know, you'd written 10 novels when it came to the animated series. And of course, you have story by credit on Star Trek, the motion picture. I can't think of many people who have straddled the two worlds like that. Back in, you know, around the time that, you know, motion pictures going into production and Star Wars at this point is, you know, people have heard of this space fantasy. What does that feel like for you as an author?
It's nice, first of all, but it's very strange because I don't regard that as my principal work. Now, I put as much into a film adaptation as I do into any book. I approach it from the standpoint of a professional writer and a 14-year-old boy sitting in the theater with his friends criticizing the lousy special effects. So pro-fan, that's the way I go into writing a novelization. But I am more focused, if you can call it that, if that's the right word, on my original work.
Of course.
Of which there is far more than there is of the novelizations. But to address your question more directly, it's not anything I planned. If I had sat down and said, this is going to be my life's plan, and I'm going to try and do this and this and this, that's one thing. But I didn't. All these things came to me. Just like I think with anybody who is a good craftsman. If you are a really good house painter or a really good plumber or a really good carpenter or a car mechanic, word gets around and word of mouth drives business to you. And I got, fortunately in this case, at the early part of my career, notice for being able to turn out a respectful, competent, readable novel in a very short period of time that did not contradict or anything really important that went on in the film. I did not cause trouble. I was not someone who would come back with an adaptation saying, well, this is my version of War and Peace. You can't change anything, or I'm going to the New York Times to complain. You have an understanding of what you're doing, and it's proportionate. And word gets around, hey, we need a book version. We just sold the book rights to this. This guy can probably do it. And that's more important from the publisher's standpoint, because the book is what's important to them, than it is from the studio standpoint. Studio has final approval. Producers have final approval of the writer of the adaptation. But it's the publisher who goes out and gets somebody. So the publishers knew, the editors knew that I could do this work. And so a lot of it came my way. As far as the Star Trek movie and experience which prompted our move to Arizona, what I discovered was I love movies. I always loved movies, but I didn't like the movie business. Some people thrive in it. It's not the kind of environment I want to swim in. And I discovered that reasonably early too, thanks to Star Trek. That's not to negate the work I did on it. But basically what happened with Star Trek was they were going back and forth for years. Are we going to make a film? Are we going to revive the TV series? You know all this. Then Star Wars came out, as you point out, and made, you know, trainloads of money. And Close Encounters came out, also did very well. And the apocryphal story is that the 12-year-old daughter of Charles Bluthorn, who was the chairman of Gulf and Western, which was the mega corporation that owned, among other things, Paramount Studios, said, "Daddy, why can't we have a Star Trek movie?" Now, there may be other reasons that are more true, I don't know, but that's a better story. And so the people at Norway Productions, which was Roddenberry's production company, and Paramount started running around like crazy saying, "We're going to do a big budget movie. Let's do the movie. Let's do something quick so that we can show them something so that we can start budgeting before they change their minds again." Now, prior to this, they were working on reviving the TV series. Many authors had been asked to submit potential story for one-hour TV shows, one-hour episodes of the show. A lot of science fiction writers were asked. I was asked because I had done, as you mentioned, the 10-volume Star Trek logs, and everybody at Norway and Paramount knew that I knew my way around the Star Trek universe. So I was asked, and I submitted three story ideas, one of which was called In Thy Image, which was picked up, and I started to develop that as a one-hour episode. Now, all of this happens with financing and Paramount, Gulf and Western, and the people say, "Let's get something going as quick as we can before they change their minds again." And the idea was to open the revived TV series with a two-hour movie for television. They looked around for a storyline that they felt could support 2 hours instead of one. My story was selected. I was asked to go back and expand it to carry 2 hours instead of one, which I did. And somebody, again, I wasn't there, so I don't know all the details. Somebody said, "Hey, we've got this treatment that's for 2 hours. Let's show them that and see what they say." And the story, as it's related in the histories of Star Trek, is that there was a meeting, and Michael Eisner, who at that time was head of Paramount, held up the treatment and said, "This is our movie." I was not there. I was never there after that, because what happened was Star Trek became a big budget motion picture instead of a revived TV series. Now there's real money and real ego involved, the second of those being the most important. And I became an instant non-person on Star Trek, the motion picture. My opinion was not solicited, which I would have given for free. Is that 14-year-old fan working, remember? One thing I figured out you don't do in Hollywood is offer to do something for free, because everybody's immediately suspicious. What's his angle? I didn't have an angle. I just wanted to see the best movie possible. But hey, and that was it until the film was finished. I went off and did my other things, Spellsinger books that I was working on and other projects. And the film was ready for release, and they were going to have a big premiere at the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. And I was invited, along with my wife, Joanne. And I talked to her and said, "What do you think I should do?" And she said, "Well, this is your call. This is up to you." And I thought about it, and I thought, well, if I showed up and met certain people, I might say certain untoward things. And there are a lot of people who I don't know and who don't know me who have worked on this film very hard for a very long time. And I did not want to rain on anybody's parade. So I stayed home, even though Paramount was ready to spring for the plane and the hotel and the limo and the whole bit. And I thought, I can live without that. I don't need that. So I stayed home. That's why I wasn't at the premiere of the film. I'm proud of the work that I did. I think the finished film is a good film. It's not a great film, but it's a good film, especially when they made some change, director's cut, and cleaned a few things up.
For sure, yeah.
But that's, you have to be able to roll with things like that. And my idea of rolling was to move to Prescott, Arizona, and write my own books. And if something came along, as many things did, do them to the best of my ability. And people say, "Well, why didn't you stay in Los Angeles? I was raised in Los Angeles. I knew people. I could drop names. Why didn't you stay in Los Angeles and write movies?" And I thought, well, I could have done that. And I would probably have more money than I do now. And I'd get maybe a 1/16th shot of myself in the back of People magazine once a year at some parties. But I'd have to be nice to people I don't want to be nice to. And I do have a tendency to speak my mind. And I don't, you know, I don't go to parties. And it was just a better decision. And my wife was not happy in Los Angeles. She's from West Texas. And we moved to, that was 42 years ago. We moved to Prescott, Arizona. And I've been very happy here ever since. I do exactly pretty much what I want. And I got to see the world, which was the main thing I wanted to do, which has influenced a lot of my work. And I certainly can't complain because I can't go to a premiere and stand in the back of a sneak preview in Pasadena and have some guy who works at the drugstore down the street come out with his wife and two kids and say, well, that was a piece of crap. What are we going to see next week? Which is what happens. So it's all worked out very well. And the people who read my books seem to think so too.
Well, there's obviously enough reading them because, I mean, the sheer scale, you know, there's about, if I have this counted correctly, in the Commonwealth Universe books, there's about 493 different volumes.
No. You're looking at Goodreads, I think, probably. That lists every iteration of every book, every hardback copy, every paperback copy. I'm sure a number of foreign editions. I mean, if you just wanted to list the foreign editions of Star Wars, you probably have 100 titles right there. It's the actual total, since you ask, is a little over 140, which is just fine. But it's not something outrageous. Even Asimov didn't do that number of books. Nobody does that number of books. There are people who've written hundreds of children's books, but you're talking about a book, maybe a fine book, that has maybe a few hundred words in it.
Yeah.
And so it's the quantifying these things is not as easy as it seems. It's not as straightforward as you might think. You look at somebody like Stephen King, who's written a fair number of books, but if you look at the number of words he's written, it's a lot more than most people with a comparable number of books, because he writes big books.
Mm.
So there's different ways of looking at it.
I suppose then my big question is, because I can see there's quite a few crossover years in terms of publication. So do you find yourself working on multiple projects at the same time? Or would you try and, as much as possible, finish a draft, move on to another project, go back to that first draft, do your editing? What's, you know, in that respect, what do you prefer to do?
Every writer works differently. I know writers who can do what you just described. I can't do it. I can't even, the only thing I can do with regards to that is if I'm working on an original novel and someone asks me to do a novelization, which everybody wants yesterday.
Of course, yeah.
And which I can write when I apply myself fairly rapidly. I can put the original novel aside and write the novelization and go back to the original novel. I cannot work in two original novels or two novelizations simultaneously. I would get the plot lines confused. I would have a hard time keeping everything separate. I can work on either a novelization or an original novel and stop and do a piece of short fiction or an essay or the column that I write. But I can't write that. I can't work on two novels or two novelizations at the same time.
I could, and that makes perfect sense, because even with the best of, say, you've got note stack number one over here, you've got note stack number two, even the most organized mind would still be like, there's just going to be an inevitable crossover, an inevitable mashing together. And why put yourself under that stress if you don't need to?
Practically, I think I could do it. I mean, if somebody presented the right offer to me, I could probably do it. But I think both books would suffer as a result. I think you need to focus on unless you're doing something short or something completely different. As I say, there are people who can do that. I can't do it.
Well, I generally struggle to get one thing done. So in that respect, and that always, I know every now and again, people will make jokes like that. No, that's actually true. I have people screaming at me for deadlines. So sorry, everyone. It's funny. So again, reading your bibliography, and Because I don't want to take it back to the film aspect. Just I saw you wrote the novelization for The Thing as well. I was like, how many of my favorite movies are you like? Is your name attached to? This is fantastic. Like, but do you find then in your original fiction, how many, you know, what kind of ideas do you find that you that come in your original fiction that might find a way into tie in or vice versa? And I don't mean reusing ideas. That's not what I mean by that.
No, there are certain things. A lot of my books focus either directly or as a background matter on ecology. They have from the very beginning. There's no reason why I can't put that in a novelization and work that in somehow. If you have a film and you have two explorers on an alien planet, and it's not written in there that there's this interesting creature that interacts with another interesting creature and that this is an important thing, because I can do that, and I will do that. The way I meant to describe certain characters, novelization, the characters are generally already there for you. They better be, or it's not a very good screenplay, and it won't be a very good movie. But I might sometimes think, well, I'm working on this original character, and I remember this character from this movie that I really liked. Can I take this aspect from that character, not transfer the whole character entire, obviously, and put that in this original character and expand upon it, which I didn't have the opportunity to do in the novelization. So there can be a certain small amount of cross-fertilization, but obviously nothing overt, because you can't fool fans. People will pick up on that stuff immediately. And I will get letters. Nowadays, I'll get email from people who are experts in a certain particular field that I have written half a paragraph about, and they will email me and say, this is complete nonsense. You know, this particular subspecies would never interact with a subspecies from this particular genera, and on and on and on and on. So you got to be real careful. And if you're a competent science fiction writer, you need to do your research before you make a, fool of yourself, which I haven't done too long.
I haven't been linked to the articles of, you know, Alan Dean Foster exposed, you know, here it goes here. Oh, I haven't been linked to those yet. So I think you're doing pretty well. Is there in say the Commonwealth series or in any of the novels that you've done, is there anything that was so off the wall that it was a challenge to get it finished in your original fiction?
To get it finished.
To sit down and go, okay, right, that's it. I'm there's the draft. There it is.
No, I generally, once I get about halfway through the book, I know where I'm going to end up and I know how to get there. At least generally, I may not have a specific thing in mind. But I can give you an example. I just finished a fantasy novel, because I also write fantasy, called Himdra the Bear. And I was about halfway through the book, and I really liked my main character. That's his name. And I could not quite figure out. I said, I can end it this way. It'll be a good ending. People will like it. But can I do anything better? And as a writer, this is what you want to do while you're writing. You don't want to take the easy way out unless you simply have to get from page 50 to page 51 and you don't know how else to do it. So you sit there and you think, well, this works. How can I make it work better for the reader? What can I do that's a little different or a little more interesting? Or I'll give you another example from Himdra the Bear, just because it's one of the most recent things I've done. There are multiple kingdoms involved, surprise, surprise. And Himdra ends up in one of them. And it is led by a queen. Her name's Salvoriana, and she is a dwarf. And I had never encountered that before. In a fantasy novel, there are lots of dwarves, obviously, in fantasy novels. But I had never encountered one where the ruler was a dwarf. And I thought, that's not a big change to make. I can do that. And then you think, how does that particular fact of her different physicality affect who she is, how she rules, how she handles this visitor? It affects everything. And it completely changed the fact that I needed a queen of this particular country. You're always looking for stuff like that. I could give you endless examples, but well, I'll give you one more. A Commonwealth book from years ago called Catchalot. Just for fun, before I even started the book, I had the main idea for the book, knew pretty much how it was going to go. Just for fun, there are no white people in the book. Now, I don't mention that. I do not anywhere in the book point that out. But if you read the book and the character descriptions, there are no Caucasian people in the entire book. Also, to add on to that, every character in the book is based on somebody I've known.
Oh, that's fun.
Most of the time, I never do anything like that. I don't base characters. The characters are invented out of whole cloth. I might take a characteristic from somebody, but the characters are all original. But everybody in that book is based on somebody I've known. Just for fun, just to do something different for my enjoyment and hopefully for the reader's enjoyment as well. The funny story I'll tell you real quick about the cover of that book, because the people involved except me are all deceased. There was a time years ago when putting a person of color on the cover of a science fiction or fantasy novel was considered to hurt sales. There are probably a number of people in the industry who still feel that way, but everything fortunately has changed for the better, including within the industry. So when Catchalot came out, the main character is a woman of Brazilian descent, takes place in the Commonwealth, so it's future. But she's of Brazilian descent, so she's dark. And her daughter, who's also a major character, is also dark. And when the paperback came out, it was a paperback original. The book involves intelligent whales. So there is a whale on the cover and a boat, which is much smaller than the whale. And standing on the boat are two very, very minuscule figures who are much smaller than the boat, obviously. And you can't even tell they're human. Now, I was not there when that cover was designed. Nothing to do with it, but I know the reason why that cover was done that way. Subsequently, the Science Fiction Book Club did an edition of it, and the characters, actually three characters in this instance, are shown properly. They're on a boat, and there's a whale, but they are shown properly. The cover artist for that book, for that Science Fiction Book Club edition, was a gentleman named Esteban Maroto, who's Filipino, who obviously had no problem depicting the characters as they actually were. Also, the Science Fiction Book Club sells books, or they did sell books, I presume they still do, by subscription. So you would join the Science Fiction Book Club, and you would buy a certain number of books a year, and it was not necessary to do covers to specifically sell the book, because the club was going to sell and does sell a certain number of books anyway. So a certain consideration, as far as cover art was concerned, was not a consideration for that particular book. Another good example, just real quick, a standalone I did called The Man Who Used the Universe. The main human character is particularly ugly.
Okay.
Paperback version for Warner Books essentially has nothing to do with the book. It's just a generic science fiction cover with generic characters on the front. The book club edition, wonderful painting by Jill Bauman, which is actually on a back wall there, although you can't see it at this distance. Shows the main character pretty much as he should look, which is very Neanderthalic, and a very ugly alien behind him. And they had no problem doing that at the book club because they can show things accurately without worrying about sales.
It is. It's fascinating as well when you see, because in a way we're all aware of it, but then when you think the people who are engaging with the material that's in the novel will have, like you say, no problem at all. We're going to deal with the characters. That's fine. And then there's the team that they sit in their marketing cube and they go, right, what do people want to see? That's what we're going to do. What's this book about? I heard the word science fiction. Right. It's going to be a science fiction book, and away it goes. And yes, you're right. I mean, like there's so many examples when you can think of seeing an image like this is, you know, this is Luke Skywalker. That's not Luke. That's nothing to do with him.
I have a The main character in the Commonwealth novels, Flinks, is a young redheaded man whose ancestry is Irish.
Wait.
Indian. So he has darker skin, but it's very light. It's like a cafe au lait, maybe even a little lighter than that. And on every cover of every edition of that book that ever came out, he is Caucasian. Every single one. It is so discouraging. Pip's all wrong on most of them, not all of them, but most of them too. And it's just like, there's no reason for this. There's no reason for this. And as an author, you know why it's being done. And you're just not only does he not look like he is described in multiple books, so there's no reason to get it wrong, but on several of them, he looks like on several of the reprints, he looks like a typical American teenager. On one of them, he positively looks like an Aryan statue that would not have been out of place in Nazi Germany. I mean, it's so frustrating. It's so frustrating.
It is. And you know, it's funny because the amount of times, because it has become so cliche for a reason, the whole don't judge a book by its cover. But even it's just like, don't assume the author had anything to do with the cover.
Well, I always tell people that there are exceptions. There are a few exceptions. I've only objected to two covers because I know there's an art director, there's a marketing department, and as strongly as I may feel, I don't want to step on other people's toes and cause trouble for their work. But there were two exceptions where I did make noise. They accepted both of my changes. No reason to go into them here. And that was fine. Now, I did a trilogy, fantasy trilogy years ago, called The Journeys of the Catechist, which starts in Africa. And I was allowed to work with the artist, Keith Parkinson, who's no longer with us, wonderful artist, on the cover designs and getting particularly the main character, a gentleman named Achole Ahomba, correct. And Warner went with it, and I was thrilled. Just recently, Open Road Media, which has reissued a lot of my books that have been out, books that have been out of print for some time, and it continues to re-release them both in ebook form, and you can get a hardcover or paperback copy too if you want, is reissuing, among other books, those books. And the first covers they sent, I felt, were not right. And I explained why, and they went back and completely reworked them, sent three new covers, which are gorgeous. They are absolutely, they're not just good, they're not just acceptable, they're gorgeous. And you have to keep in mind, these are primarily ebooks where people are only going to see the covers on an ordering site this big. And for them to go to that much trouble for that, I thought was really respectful, and you would wish that every publisher would be like that. Of course, people who order, print versions of the books are going to get the full impact of the cover. But that's an instance where I say, yeah, you can look at this cover and this is what's inside the book. And you love as an author to be able to do that. Doesn't happen very often, doesn't happen all the time. I had one set of covers that were done that were not very accurate, but they were accurate enough, but they were great covers for selling the story, for selling a book. So science fiction fans will love these covers. Then they'll read the book and say, well, this isn't quite accurate. This isn't quite accurate. But it wasn't egregious. So you leave it alone because you know the cover will sell the book. And then people will pick up the book. It's just like in the old days, more so in the old days than now, when people would go to the movies and they would see previews of coming attractions. And maybe those were just a little bit, particularly the verbal accompaniment, just a little bit off, a little over the top. But you knew, the studios knew, that would sell the film. And as a filmmaker, then you would go and you would know that people would see your film and they would judge the film. So
it's funny because I can think of a few trailers already off the top of my head that are very like that. You know, it's like, yep, I can definitely think of a few that this isn't the film I was expecting. Alan, you've been very, very generous with your time. So thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I am, as I said at the beginning, and I don't say it hyperbole, I'm a little bit in awe. I know I don't know you very well, but I am absolutely delighted for the complete, you know, living the life I want to live, quite frankly. You've worked in all the big franchises I want to work in. You've got in like libraries full of series yourself. If someone wanted to start reading the Alan Dean Foster originals, where would you advise them to go? What would be book number one to start?
I always, if I had to pick a novel, I would pick Midworld, which was the Second Commonwealth. No, it wasn't Second Commonwealth. See, it's a long time ago. I picked Midworld or Nor Crystal Tears, which I think are very typical of my work. They're both Commonwealth books. I also advise people, if they're not sure, I have, I don't know, half a dozen or seven short story collections out. And I always tell people, particularly those who don't know a lot about science fiction or fantasy, I say, pick one of these up. If you don't like the first story, maybe you'll like the fourth story or the eighth story. And of course, each story being completely different story-wise, it's a good way for people, I think, to get into any author. Not me necessarily, but if you want to read about an author, and they do short stories, obviously, read their short stories first, and that'll give you a good idea and good variety. I can also recommend one particular book, since we've talked about the subject a lot here, a book that came out from Centipede Press recently and is now available, I think, also from Open Road Media, called The Director Should Have Shot You. There's a story behind the title, too. There's a story behind everything. People have asked me questions like you have asked me for years about the film novelizations. And I thought, you know, this is history of a sort. People are interested in it. I didn't take notes when I was doing these things, but I have a pretty good memory. And I put together this book. It's a memoir, really, of my involvement in all the novelizations I have done, starting with Luana in 1973, and the last one being Alien Covenant. So if people want to find out more about my work on Star Wars or Alien or the Chronicles of Riddick or The Thing or the Star Trek logs or anything else, pick up that book. It's got a lot of nice pictures in it, and I get to be snarky about them in the subtitles and in the captions, excuse me. So there's that. And the last thing is, Buffalo, New York is going to host the 2024 NASFIC, and I will be the author guest of honor, although I assume most of my Irish fans will take the short hop over to Glasgow and go to the Worldcon. That makes perfect sense as well. But I did want to mention that in case there are people who are dedicated fans who go to both. And at least you can also see Niagara Falls if you go to the Buffalo NASFIC.
That's a good sales pitch.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, that's a good sales pitch, the Niagara Falls one. I like it.
Yeah, the author guest of honor at Worldcon is a very good old friend of mine, a wonderful writer named Nnedi Okorafor. I went to the previous Worldcon in Glasgow, so I don't feel like I'm missing too much. Subsequent to which, I rented a car and drove up to John O'Groats and took the ferry with my car over the Orkneys. And that was a whole story I could tell in myself. There was a big North Atlantic storm coming in, and I had to rush. I'm not going to tell the whole story. I'll take up too much time. But basically, I had to find a cargo ferry to take me and my car out of the Orkneys. And wonderful experience. You look for these things, and they all end up in books eventually. And that's a large part of what being a writer is the unexpected developments.
I love it because you're dead right. I mean, you read something that seems like it's the most fantastical thing on the page, and actually it was a storm came in and I had to find a cargo boat and away we went.
I did a book years ago, my only contemporary novel called Primal Shadows, which Clive Cussler liked quite a bit, actually. And it's all based on my multiple trips to Papua New Guinea. And all of the stuff that I thought I was going to write, I had to throw away because it's such an amazing, fantastical place. I didn't even need to make it science fiction or fantasy. I just worked the true stories that I had heard into the book. So whenever you can do something like that, it's always a marvelous thing.
Nice. That is just, it's cool. And it's such wonderful advice as well for young aspiring writers. Like, you know, that is, it's fantastic. Alan, thank you so much. You're a gentleman through and through. Thank you very much. If you don't mind, there is a question we ask of every guest. So before I let you go, in a way, you've already answered this one, but for the soundbite, Alan Dean Foster, what does Star Trek mean to you?
It means that people have a hopeful vision of the future, and not everything is picking up a gun and shooting somebody you don't agree with, because it's a poor way of convincing somebody of the rightness of your argument. And Star Trek emphasizes that, real Star Trek. So that's what Star Trek means to me. It means there's a potentially hopeful future where we can use logic and reason instead of guns to settle differences and find explanations for things.
I love it. It's perfect. Thank you so much. Now, I'll leave you go. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to getting the Director Should Have Shot You book.
I hope you enjoy it.
I will. Alan, thank you very much. Have a lovely day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Pushing along. How special was that? You are just wonderful. Thank you so much for watching along. We will, of course, be back next week with another episode of The War Room. I have been Sean. You have been wonderful. Thank you so much. Live long and prosper.